If you go in twice and get hurt, consider yourself a sucker. Love is by far my scariest arena. I couldn't reconcile the fear I felt standing there in the lake muck with the fact that I had just written a book about vulnerability and daring. So I told myself, put your heart where your mouth is. I flashed a smile in hopes of softening him up and doubled down on my bid for connection. This is so great. I love that we're doing this. I feel really close to you. He seemed to be looking through me rather than at me when he replied, yep, good swim. Then he took off again. This is total horseshit, I thought. What is going on? I don't know if I'm supposed to feel humiliated or hostile. I wanted to cry and I wanted to scream. Instead, fueled by anxiety, I took a deep breath and started swimming back across the cove. I beat Steve back to the dock by a few strokes. I was physically and emotionally exhausted. I was even a little lightheaded. Once Steve reached the dock, he went straight to the rickety metal ladder and started pulling himself out of the water. Can you get back in the water? I said to him. It's all I could manage. He stopped climbing and turned his head toward me with both hands still on the ladder. Get back in the water, please. He lowered himself into the lake. What's up? He asked as we faced each other in treaded water next to the dock. What's up? I thought. He wants to know what's up. I have no idea what's up. All I knew was that I had already scripted the rest of the morning on the swim back, and without an intervention, we were headed toward a terrible day. We had done this fight 1,000 times. We'd climb up onto the dock, dry off, and head into the house. We'd throw our towels over the porch rail, walk into the kitchen, and Steve would say, "What's for breakfast, babe?" I'd look at him and fire off a sarcastic, "I don't know, babe. Let me ask the breakfast fairy." Then I'd raise my eyes to the ceiling and put my hands on my hips. "Oh, breakfast fairy, what's for breakfast?" And after a sufficiently long, dramatic pause, I'd launch into this oldie but goodie. "Gee, Steve, I forgot how vacation works. I forgot that I'm in charge of breakfast and lunch and dinner and laundry and packing and goggles and sunscreen and bug spray and groceries and somewhere in the litany, Steve would scrunch up his face and insert a genuinely confused, "Did something happen? Did I miss something?" Then, somewhere between 4 and 24 hours of Cold War maneuvering would unfold. We could do this argument with our eyes closed, but this was Lake Travis, and this was our special vacation. I wanted something different. I looked at him, and rather than launching into blaming, I tried a new approach. "I've been trying to connect with you, and you keep blowing me off. I don't get it." He just stared at me. The water was about 30 feet deep at the dock, and we were treading water the entire time. So I had to think quick. This was all new to me. In the course of what felt like an hour, but was probably 30 seconds, I went back and forth in my head. Be kind. No, get him. Be kind. No, self-protect. Take him down. Opting for kind and trusting, I relied completely on a technique I had learned from my research, a phrase that emerged in numerous variations over and over again. I said, "I feel like you're blowing me off, and the story I'm making up is either that you looked over at me while I was swimming and thought, 'Man, she's getting old. She can't even swim freestyle anymore.' Or you saw me and thought, 'She sure as hell doesn't rock a Speedo like she did 25 years ago.'" Steve seemed agitated. He doesn't lash out when he's frustrated. He takes deep breaths, purses his lips, and nods his head. This probably serves him well in his job as a pediatrician, but I know his tells. He was agitated. He turned his back to me, then turned back around before saying, "Shit, you're being vulnerable, right?" This answer took no time. "Yes. Yes, I am. But I'm right on the edge of rage, so what you say matters a lot." The phrase, "the story I'm making up," may have emerged from the research as an important tool. but this was my first time using it, and I literally and emotionally felt out of my depth. Steve turned away again and back again, and after what seemed like another eternity, he finally said, "I don't want to do this with you. I really don't." My immediate reaction was panic. What's going on? What does that mean? I don't want to do this with you? Holy crap, does that mean he doesn't want to swim with me or talk to me? Then it flashed into my head that maybe the "this" he meant was being married. Time slowed down, and I went to that slow motion frame by frame panic, only to be ripped back into reality when he said, "No, I really don't want to have this conversation with you right now." I was out of tools. I was out of patience. Too bad. We're having this conversation right now. See? I'm talking, then you're talking. We're having this conversation. After a few seconds of weird silence and turning away from me in the water, Steve finally faced me and said, "Look, I don't mind hanging out with the kids. I really don't." What? I was so confused. What do you mean? What are you talking about? Steve explained that he didn't mind taking the kids across the cove on blow-up rafts. He actually enjoyed pulling them across so they could find their secret treasure, and he loved giving me the time to hang out with my sisters. Completely freaked out at this point, I raised my voice and said, "What are you talking about? What are you saying?" Steve took a deep breath and, in a voice that was equal parts agitation and resignation, said, "I don't know what you were saying to me today. I have no idea. I was fighting off a total panic attack during that entire swim. I was just trying to stay focused by counting my strokes." There was silence. He continued, "Last night I had a dream that I had all five of the kids on the raft and we were halfway across the cove when a speedboat came hauling towards us. I waved my hands in the air and they didn't even slow down. I finally grabbed all five of the kids and went as deep as I could go. But hell, Brene, Ellen and Lorna can swim, but Gabby, Amaya, and Charlie are little and it's 60 feet deep. I grabbed them off the raft and I pulled them as deep as I could go. I held them down there and waited for the boat to pass over us. I knew if we surfaced, we'd be killed. So I waited. But at one point, I looked over at Charlie and I could tell he was out of breath. I knew he would drown if we stayed down one more minute. I don't know what you were saying. I was just counting my strokes and trying to get back to the dock." My heart hurt and my eyes filled with tears. It made sense. We'd arrived at the house on a weekday when the lake is pretty quiet. Today was Friday. Traffic on the lake would double during the weekend and drunk boaters would be a given. When you grow up around water people, you hear a lot of stories about boating and skiing accidents caused by drinking. And, tragically, you often know people deeply affected by these events. "I'm so glad you told me, Steve." He rolled his eyes. "Bullshit." "Oh my God, make this conversation stop. Now what? I couldn't believe it. What are you saying? Of course I'm glad you told me." Steve shook his head and said, "Look, don't quote your research to me, please. Don't tell me what you think you're supposed to say. I know what you want. You want the tough guy. You want the guy who can rescue the kids in the path of a speeding boat by throwing them to the shore and swimming so fast that he's there to catch them before they land. The guy who then looks over at you across the cove and shouts, 'Don't worry, babe, I got this.'" He was hurting, and I was hurting. We were both tired and at the absolute edge of our vulnerability. We owed each other the truth. I wouldn't quote my research at him, but I've been doing that research long enough to know that as much as we'd love to blame distant or cruel fathers, bullying buddies, and overbearing coaches for the lion's share of shame that men feel, women can be the most fearful about letting men off the white horse and the most likely to be critical of their vulnerability. I often say, show me a woman who can hold space for a man in real fear and vulnerability, and I'll show you a woman who's learned to embrace her own vulnerability and who doesn't derive her power or status from that man. Show me a man who can sit with a woman in real fear and vulnerability and just hear her struggle without trying to fix it or give advice. And I'll show you a man who's comfortable with his own vulnerability and doesn't derive his power from being Oz, the all-knowing and all-powerful. I reached out and grabbed Steve's hand. You know what? 10 years ago, this story would have scared me. I'm not sure I could have handled it. I might have said the right thing, but a couple of days later, if something triggered it, I might have brought it up in a crappy way, like, are you sure you're feeling up to taking the kids tubing? I would have screwed up. I would have hurt you and betrayed your trust. I'm sure I have in the past, and I'm truly sorry. 5 years ago, I would have been better. I would have understood and been respectful, but probably still fearful. Today, I'm so grateful for you and our relationship. I don't want anything or anyone but you. I'm learning how to be afraid. You're the best man I know. Plus, we're all we have. We are the big door prize. Steve smiled. I was speaking in code, but he knew what I meant. The big door prize is a line from one of our favorite songs, In Spite of Ourselves, by John Prine and Iris DeMent. It's one of our favorite date songs, and the chorus always reminds me of Steve. In spite of ourselves, we'll end up a-sittin' on a rainbow. Against all odds, honey, we're the big door prize. We're gonna spite our noses right off of our faces. There won't be nothing but big ol' hearts dancing in our eyes. We climbed up on the dock, dried off, and started up the stairs. Steve snapped me on the butt with his wet towel and smiled. Just so you know, you still rock a Speedo. That morning was a turning point in our relationship. There we were, both of us completely engulfed in our shame stories. I was stuck in appearance and body image fear, the most common shame trigger for women. He was afraid I would think he was weak, the most common shame trigger for men. Both of us were scared to embrace our own vulnerabilities, even knowing full well that vulnerability is the only path out of the shame storm and back to each other. Somehow, we managed to find the courage to trust ourselves and each other, avoiding both the hot sting of words we would never be able to take back and the withheld affection of a Cold War. That morning revolutionized how we thought about our marriage. It wasn't a subtle evolution. It forever shifted our relationship, and that was a good thing. For me, this became a story of great possibility, of what could be if our best selves showed up when we were angry or frustrated or hurt. Our fights didn't normally go so well. This was transformative. In fact, it was such a powerful story that I asked Steve what he thought about my using it as an example of the power of vulnerability when I speak in public. He said, of course, it really is a pretty amazing story. We were able to resurrect some of these skills we learned at the lake in later arguments, but for some reason unknown to me at the time, those subsequent showdowns were never as good or as productive as the one that day. I was convinced that it was the magic of Lake Travis, or the majesty of nature itself, that made us more gentle and loving with each other. I would eventually learn that there was much more to the story. You can't skip day two. Fast forward 2 years, and I find myself on a stage sharing the Lake Travis story with a standing room only crowd at Pixar Animation Studios. First, like so many things in my life, synchronicity figured in to how I ended up at Pixar. I was in some U.S. airport waiting on a delayed plane when I went to the airport store to find something to read. I was surprised to see Eric Clapton on the cover of Fast Company, one of my favorite magazines, so I bought it and stuck it in my bag. When we finally took off, I pulled out my magazine and upon closer examination realized it was not Eric Clapton. It was a rock and roll photo of Ed Catmull. The article was about his new book. Ed is the president of Pixar Animation and Walt Disney Animation Studios, and it's fair to say that his leadership book, Creativity, Inc., would go on to influence me as much as anything I've ever read. His lessons on how strong leaders must identify the things that kill trust and creativity in order to nurture cultures and conditions that allow good people to do what they do best changed how I think about my role in my organization and even in my family. After I gave copies to everyone on my team, his ideas and concepts quickly became part of our vernacular at work. I was so impressed by Ed's work that I reached out to my editor at Random House, also Ed's publisher, to ask for an introduction. I was hoping to interview him for this book. As it turned out, Ed and a core group of folks at Pixar had seen my TED Talks. They promptly asked if I'd like to come out and spend the day with them. My first thought was, will it be too much if I show up dressed as Jesse from Toy Story? Hell yes, I'm coming for a visit. Okay, many people would file our mutual interest in connecting under random coincidence. I file it under God thing. Or, as novelist Paulo Coelho talks about in his book, The Alchemist, when you're on your path, the universe will conspire to help you. After giving my talk, I had lunch with Ed and some of the leaders at Pixar, mostly producers, directors, animators, and writers. The conversation focused on the unavoidable uncertainty, vulnerability, and discomfort of the creative process. As they were explaining how frustrating it is that absolutely no amount of experience or success gives you a free pass from the daunting level of doubt that is an unyielding part of the process, I thought about my own experiences with the Daring Way. The Daring Way is a certification program for professionals in helping fields who want to facilitate my work. In our national training seminars, we use a 3-day intensive model as our primary teaching tool. Our faculty members go through the curriculum with small groups of 10 to 12 people, allowing new candidates both to experience the work as participants and to learn the research behind the curriculum. No matter how many times we've done it and how many people we've certified, day 2 of this 3-day model still sucks. In fact, certified facilitators who go on to use the 3-day model with their clients always tell us, I thought I could do it better and make day 2 easier, but I can't. It's still so hard. All of a sudden, when I was at Pixar, clarity struck. I looked at Ed and said, oh my God, I totally get this. You can't skip day 2. Ed immediately knew I got it. He smiled in a way that conveyed, right. No skipping the middle. Day 2, or whatever that middle space is for your own process, is when you're in the dark. The door has closed behind you. You're too far in to turn around and not close enough to the end to see the light. In my work with veterans and active members of the military, we've talked about this dark middle. They all know it as the point of no return, an aviation term coined by pilots for the point in a flight when they have too little fuel to return to the originating airfield. It's strangely universal, going all the way back to Julius Caesar's famous, "The die is cast," spoken in 49 BC as he and his troops made the river crossing that started a war. Whether it's ancient battle strategy or the creative process, at some point you're in, it's dark, and there's no turning back. With the Daring Way groups, day 2 means we're moving into the shame and worthiness part of the curriculum, and people are feeling raw. The shine of a new undertaking and the sparkle of possibility have dulled, leaving behind a dense fog of uncertainty. People are tired. With our groups, and groups in general, you're also hitting the rocky part of what Bruce Tuckman, a group dynamics researcher, describes as the form, storm, norm, perform cycle. When a group or team first comes together, we call that forming. It's often rocky for a time while members figure out the dynamics. That's storming. At some point, the group finds its groove, or norms, and then they start to make headway, perform. Storm occupies the middle space. It's not only a dark and vulnerable time, but also one that's often turbulent. people find all kinds of creative ways to resist the dark, including taking issue with each other. What I think sucks the most about Day 2 is exactly what Ed and the Pixar team pointed out. It is a non-negotiable part of the process. Experience and success don't give you easy passage through the middle space of struggle. They only grant you a little grace, a grace that whispers, "This is part of the process. Stay the course." Experience doesn't create even a single spark of light in the darkness of the middle space. It only instills in you a little bit of faith in your ability to navigate the dark. The middle is messy, but it's also where the magic happens. As we wrapped up our lunch conversation at Pixar, one of the writers in the room shared a keen observation about our discussion. Day 2 is like the second act in our stories. It's always the toughest for our teams. It's always where we struggle with our characters and our narrative arc. Everyone in the room responded with an emphatic nod or a passionate yes. After I got back to Houston, Ed sent me an email saying that our conversation about Day 2 had sent a jolt through the room. I had no idea at the time how the jolt and my entire Pixar visit would eventually affect me personally and professionally. Hanging on the wall of Pixar's Story Corner display were these three sentences. Story is the big picture. Story is process. Story is research. An image of a crown was at the top of the wall, symbolizing the axiom that story is king. When I got home, I used Post-it notes to recreate that wall in my study, just to remind myself of the importance of story in our lives. It also turned out to foreshadow something important for me. I knew the trip to Pixar meant more than a great day with gifted people. There was something else to it. I just didn't know then how strong the reverberating power of that jolt would be. Before my Pixar visit, I'd never thought much about the science of storytelling. I'd certainly never used any conscious storytelling calculus in designing my talks. In fact, when I read the occasional analysis of my TED Talks, I'm shocked to see how people take the smallest gestures, from glances to pauses, and use them to apply labels and formulas to my work. At minute 4, Brené shifts her body to the left and gives a slight half-grin. This is known as the soft smile pivot and should be used with extreme care. I'm exaggerating a bit, but not much. It's so weird. I appreciate good storytelling, and I know it's not easy. I assumed that I learned storytelling from the long line of raconteurs from whence I came. I think my upbringing, combined with years of studying the science and art of teaching, led me to become an accidental storyteller. And while I might be able to make my way through a story, I knew I needed to learn more about the craft for one reason. Storytelling was emerging as a key variable in my most recent study. So I did what I do best, research. I emailed Darla Anderson, a producer I had met at Pixar, who was behind some of my favorite films, including Toy Story 3, Monsters, Inc., A Bug's Life, and Cars. I asked her if she could help me understand how people at Pixar think about the traditional three-act structure of storytelling. Even though I was amassing a growing number of books and articles on everything from the neuroscience of storytelling to screenwriting, I wanted to hear the process explained by someone who lives the work, someone who has it in her bones. That's where my richest data comes from. A person's lived experiences. Darla was great. She had already emailed me about how her team was still talking about vulnerability and how Rock the Speedo had become a touchstone among the Pixar crew. In a couple of emails, Darla helped me get my head around the three acts. Act 1. The protagonist is called to adventure and accepts the adventure. The rules of the world are established, and the end of Act 1 is the inciting incident. Act 2. The protagonist looks for every comfortable way to solve the problem. By the climax, he learns what it's really going to take to solve the problem. This act includes the lowest of the low. Act 3. The protagonist needs to prove she's learned the lesson, usually showing a willingness to prove this at all costs. This is all about redemption. An enlightened character knowing what to do to resolve a conflict. My first thought was, holy crap, this is Joseph Campbell's hero's journey. Joseph Campbell was an American scholar, professor, and writer best known for his work on comparative mythology and religion. Campbell found that countless myths from different times and cultures share fundamental structures and stages, which he called the hero's journey, or the monomyth. He introduced this idea in his book, The Hero with a Thousand Faces, which I read in my 20s and again in my mid-30s. When I was growing up, my mom's bookshelves were stacked high with books by Joseph Campbell and Carl Jung. This new insight made me realize that in addition to my dad's campfire storytelling, I had been exposed to more about the art of story than I realized. I shot an email to Darla asking her if my Campbell comparison was on target, and she replied, yep. We reference Joseph Campbell and the hero's journey at the beginning of every film. It started to make sense, and before I knew it, I had the opportunity to apply what I was learning to my own story. One afternoon, after a really hard conversation with Steve about our seemingly different approaches to homework checking, an argument that did not end up with a towel slap on the butt and a compliment, but rather with my recommendation that we stop arguing before we say something we'll regret, I sat alone in my study, staring at my version of Pixar's story wall. Maybe we should only fight when we're in the lake. Maybe I'm holding on to the Lake Travis story because it's an anomaly. None of these arguments we'd had since then had ended that well. I started to play the story over in my head and glanced up at my story wall, where I had stuck a giant post-it note outlining the three acts. Increasingly frustrated about Steve's and my inability to show up and work things out the way we did in Austin, I decided to map our lake story into the three acts. Maybe I would learn something new. Here's what I came up with. Act 1, the call to adventure of swimming across the lake. Inciting incident, Steve blows me off when I'm being vulnerable and trying to connect. Act 2, nothing really, just a crappy, anxiety-fueled swim back. Act 3, we lean into the discomfort and the vulnerability and we work it out. Then, the jolt coursed through my body, literally from the top of my head to the bottom of my feet. You can't skip day two. You can't skip day two. You can't skip day two. Where is the messy middle? Where is act two? I had told this story 50 times, but I had never fleshed out the second act, much less told it. What about the crappy swim back to the dock? What if the key to the lake story happened under the water, not on it? It popped into my head that both Carl Jung and Joseph Campbell wrote about water as a symbol of the unconscious. Symbolism and metaphor are embedded in our storytelling genes, but I don't normally use terms like consciousness or the unconscious. I believe in the concepts, but those words don't feel very accessible or practical. They just don't resonate with or speak to me. I prefer awake or aware. Still, it was clear that something had been happening beyond my awareness, and what better symbol exists for beyond our awareness than deep water? The anxiety that Steve and I both experienced while swimming that day is not uncommon for swimmers and divers. You give up a lot when you venture into an environment that you can't control and where your senses don't serve you in dependable ways. Hunter S. Thompson wrote, "Civilization ends at the waterline. Beyond that, we all enter the food chain and not always right at the top." Was I just unaware of what really transpired that day? Had I been telling the civilized version of the story? Was something important happening beyond my understanding until now? I got out my research journal and started writing down everything I could remember from my swim back to the dock. First, the swim back was terrible. It felt as if I were swimming through quicksand. Goggles kept the water out of my eyes, but you can't see 2 feet in front of you in Lake Travis. Even as a child, I wondered how the blue-green water could be so thick. I remembered at one point about halfway back to the dock getting really anxious. I started thinking, what's below me? Are there bodies under there? Are there snakes? In a devastating turn, Paw, Aunt Lorena's neighbor that I mentioned earlier, drowned in the lake when I was 8 years old. He was fishing off the dock by himself, fell in the water, hit his head on the way down and died. As I swam on, my imagination went wild, and I started freaking myself out, which, to be honest, doesn't take much for me in lakes or oceans. Just when I would feel the urge to flip onto my back and start floating until someone could rescue me from my own dammed-up reservoir of anxiety, I'd pull myself together. In addition to battling the deep water crazies, I was running through a series of random questions about Steve and the situation at hand. I was playing out scenarios and reality checking myself as I made my way through the opaque water. I couldn't see anything, but I felt everything. It was as if the very emotion that my brain was generating had added 50-pound weights around my ankles. I could barely get my legs to keep kicking. Normally, I love the weightlessness of water. On this swim, I just felt like sinking. The more I wrote in my journal, the more surprised I was by the vividness of the memories from that day. I switched to capturing the moments in a numbered list. 1. Early in the swim, I started off telling myself a version of the story that allowed me to be the victim and the hero, and that ended with Steve getting paid back when he least expected it. 2. I kept thinking to myself with each stroke, I'm so pissed, I'm so pissed. But after a few minutes, I fessed up. I had learned several years before that when I'm planning payback or rehearsing a conversation where I'm being super mean or trying to make someone feel bad, I'm normally not mad, I'm hurt, feeling uncomfortably vulnerable or feeling shame. I was all three during that swim back. I was hurt that he had pushed me away and feeling shame over why. 3. I then started wrestling with the payback story. I hate that ending of Steve getting his, but it's the one I do best when I'm hurt. The only way I could possibly change the ending was to tell a different story, one where Steve's intentions were not bad. I bombarded myself with questions while I was swimming. Could I be that generous? Do I have a part in this? Can I trust him? Do I trust myself? What's the most generous assumption that I can make about his response, while still acknowledging my own feelings and needs? 4. The question that was the hardest to answer that day involves the most vulnerable decision I have to make when I'm afraid or angry. What are the consequences of putting down the weapons and taking off the armor? What if he was hurting me on purpose? What if he's really an insensitive person? If I give him the benefit of the doubt and I'm wrong, I'll be doubly shamed for being rejected and naive. Of course, this was the point in the swim when I started worrying about bodies in the water and krakens, those giant squids feared by generations of sailors. I actually remember thinking that morning about that scene in the second Pirates of the Caribbean film when Davy Jones yells, "Release the Kraken!" I mean, it's no wonder I was lightheaded by the time I got back. 5. I remember wishing I could talk to my sisters about this before I screwed it up. Before I could write and punctuate number 6 in the growing list in my journal, a second big jolt hit me. Oh my God, those weren't random questions that I had been trying to answer that morning. These questions were concepts emerging from my ongoing research on overcoming adversity. For a year, I had been telling this story as an example of vulnerability and shame resilience. Little did I know that what lay beneath the story, in that murky water, was also the story of rising strong. When I was writing Daring Greatly, I decided not to include what I was learning about overcoming adversity. Not only was it too much to include in a book that was already introducing huge concepts like vulnerability and scarcity, I also didn't fully understand it yet. I knew the elements of shame resilience and the role that vulnerability plays in being brave, but as far as the actual process of rising strong went, I was only clear on the basics. I had yet to sort out the process and label the pieces. Looking back on how my research played out under the water that summer, I was caught off guard by the applicability of what I was learning about Rising Strong to smaller, everyday situations, like the incident at the lake. I thought I was working on a process for addressing life's major struggles. Like everyone, I know failure, and I know heartbreak. I've survived the kind of professional failures and personal heartbreaks that rearrange your life. While a hallmark of grounded theory research is that it generates basic social processes that have extremely broad application, I had worried about whether Rising Strong could address a wide range of issues, or if I even wanted it to. Would its power be somehow diminished if we applied it to smaller events, like the fight at the lake? The answer is no. Comparative suffering has taught me not to discount the importance of having a process to navigate everyday hurts and disappointments. They can shape who we are and how we feel just as much as those things that we consider the big events do. I still think Lake Travis is a magical place, but not because it washed away Steve's and my conflict. It was a revolutionary moment in our relationship that could happen only because we had each owned our stories. We didn't just figure it out and lean into vulnerability. Like Darla had spelled out in her email, our act two was trying every comfortable way to solve the problem before we finally gave in to our truths. Having spent the past 2 years drilling down into the smaller pieces of the Rising Strong process to understand how each part of it works and how the pieces fit together, I can look back now and see exactly why things happened that summer morning. I was working through the process. The Rising Strong process. The goal of the process is to rise from our falls, overcome our mistakes, and face hurt in a way that brings more wisdom and wholeheartedness into our lives. The reckoning, walking into our story. Recognize emotion and get curious about our feelings and how they connect with the way we think and behave. The rumble, owning our story. Get honest about the stories we're making up about our struggle, then challenge these confabulations and assumptions to determine what's truth, what self-protection, and what needs to change if we want to lead more wholehearted lives. The revolution. Write a new ending to our story based on the key learnings from our rumble and use this new, braver story to change how we engage with the world and to ultimately transform the way we live, love, parent, and lead. The irony is that we attempt to disown our difficult stories to appear more whole or more acceptable. But our wholeness, even our wholeheartedness, actually depends on the integration of all of our experiences, including the falls. Chapter 3. Owning Our Stories. A map does not just chart. It unlocks and formulates meaning. It forms bridges between here and there, between disparate ideas that we did not know were previously connected. Rafe Larson. I love maps not because they dictate the route or tell me when or how to travel, but simply because they mark the waypoints I will eventually visit. Knowing that these places exist and that they are well-traveled, even if they are unexplored by me, is powerful. I have charted the map of the Rising Strong process from the stories and experiences of men and women who have found wholehearted ways to navigate struggle. This process teaches us how to own our stories of falling down, screwing up, and facing hurt so that we can integrate those stories into our lives and write daring new endings. Owning our story and loving ourselves through that process is the bravest thing we'll ever do. I still believe in this quote from two of my previous books, maybe now more than ever. But I know that it takes more than courage to own your story. We own our stories so we don't spend our lives being defined by them or denying them. And while the journey is long and difficult at times, it is the path to living a more wholehearted life. The Rising Strong process. The goal of this process is to rise from our falls, overcome our mistakes, and face hurt in a way that brings more wisdom and wholeheartedness. The Reckoning. Men and women who rise strong are willing and able to reckon with their emotions. First, they recognize that they're feeling something. A button has been pushed. They're hooked. Something is triggered. Their emotions are off kilter. Second, they get curious about what's happening and how what they're feeling is connected to their thoughts and behaviors. Engaging in this process is how we walk into our story. The Rumble. Men and women who rise strong are willing and able to rumble with their stories. By rumble, I mean they get honest about the stories they've made up about their struggles, and they are willing to revisit, challenge, and reality check these narratives as they dig into topics such as boundaries, shame, blame, resentment, heartbreak, generosity, and forgiveness. Rumbling with these topics and moving from our first responses to a deeper understanding of our thoughts, feelings, and behaviors gives birth to key learnings about who we are and how we engage with others. The rumble is where wholeheartedness is cultivated and change begins. The revolution. Unlike evolutionary change, which is incremental, revolutionary change fundamentally transforms our thoughts and beliefs. Rumbling with our story and owning our truth in order to write a new, more courageous ending transforms who we are and how we engage with the world. Men and women who rise strong integrate the key learnings that emerge from the Rising Strong process into how they live, love, lead, parent, and participate as citizens. This has tremendous ramifications not only for their own lives, but also for their families, organizations, and communities. Integrating. The Latin root of the word integrate is integrare, which means to make whole. Integrating is the engine that moves us through the reckoning, the rumble, and the revolution. And the goal of each of these processes is to make ourselves whole. Participants spoke about the importance of feeling genuine, authentic, and whole, rather than always compartmentalizing their lives or hiding parts of themselves or editing their stories. The tools they used to integrate their stories of falling are readily available to all of us because they are deeply human and part of our wholeness, storytelling, and creativity. Primarily writing about or taking notes on their experiences. Integration through creativity. Steve Jobs believed that creativity is just connecting things. He believed that creating was connecting the dots between the experiences we've had to synthesize new things. He argued that this is only possible if we have more experiences or devote more time to thinking about our experiences. I agree. This is exactly why creativity is such a powerful integration tool. Creating is the act of paying attention to our experiences and connecting the dots so we can learn more about ourselves and the world around us. In addition to teaching creativity-based courses and learning from that process, I was able to interview more than 100 creatives in this research. No group taught me more about the inherently tough middle space of processes and the power of integration. For our purposes, we need to do just a little writing. Nothing formal, just jotting down some notes on our experiences. Of course, you're welcome to do something more elaborate, but it's not necessary. It's devoting time and attention to our experiences that really matters. Among the professional storytellers I interviewed for this book was Shonda Rhimes, the creator and showrunner of Grey's Anatomy and Scandal, and one of my favorite story writers. When I asked her about the role of struggle in storytelling, she said, "I don't even know who a character is until I've seen how they handle adversity. On screen and off screen, that's how you know who someone is." If integrate means to make whole, then its opposite is to fracture, disown, disjoin, detach, unravel, or separate. I think many of us move through the world feeling this way. The irony is that we attempt to disown our difficult stories to appear more whole or more acceptable. But our wholeness, even our wholeheartedness, actually depends on the integration of all of our experiences, including the falls. Curiosity is a shit starter, but that's okay. Sometimes we have to rumble with a story to find the truth. Chapter 4, The Reckoning. The big question is whether you're going to be able to say a hearty yes to your adventure. Joseph Campbell. You may not have signed up for a hero's journey, but the second you fell down, got your butt kicked, suffered a disappointment, screwed up, or felt your heart break, it started. It doesn't matter whether we are ready for an emotional adventure. Hurt happens. And it happens to every single one of us, without exception. The only decision we get to make is what role we'll play in our own lives. Do we want to write the story, or do we want to hand that power over to someone else? Choosing to write our own story means getting uncomfortable. It's choosing courage over comfort. One of the truisms of wholehearted living is you either walk into your story and own your truth, or you live outside your story hustling for your worthiness. Walking into a story about falling down can feel like being swallowed whole by emotion. Our bodies often respond before our conscious minds, and they are hardwired to protect, to run, or fight. Even with small, everyday conflicts and disappointments, physical and emotional intolerance for discomfort is the primary reason we linger on the outskirts of our stories, never truly facing them or integrating them into our lives. We disengage to self-protect. In navigation, the term reckoning, as in dead reckoning, is the process of calculating where you are. To do that, you have to know where you've been and what factors influenced how you got to where you are now. Speed, course, wind, etc. Without reckoning, you can't chart a future course. In the Rising Strong process, we can't chart a brave new course until we recognize exactly where we are, get curious about how we got there, and decide where we want to go. Ours is an emotional reckoning. There is a clear pattern among the women and men who demonstrate the ability to rise strong from hurt or adversity. They reckon with emotion. The word reckon comes from the Middle English reckonin, meaning to narrate or to make an account. The Rising Strong reckoning has two deceptively simple parts. One, engaging with our feelings, and two, getting curious about the story behind the feelings. What emotions we're experiencing and how they are connected to our thoughts and behaviors. First, Rising Strong requires us to recognize that we're experiencing a face-down in the arena moment, an emotional reaction. Remember, these moments can be small, and we're susceptible to them any time we're trying to show up and be seen. A button is pushed, a sense of disappointment or anger washes over us, our hearts race, something tells us that all is not well. We're hooked. The good news is that in our reckoning, we don't have to pinpoint the emotion accurately. We just need to recognize that we're feeling something. There will be time to sort out exactly what we're feeling later. Examples might include, I don't know what's happening, but I just want to hide. Or, I just know I want to punch a wall. Or, I want Oreos, lots of them. Or maybe it's a fill-in-the-blank, like, I feel disappointed, regretful, pissed, confused, worried, heartbroken. Or, I am in a lot of pain, feeling really vulnerable, embarrassed, in a world of hurt, overwhelmed. Or, like in my lake story, Steve ignored my bid for connection, and now I'm feeling something between anger and fear. Or maybe it's just a physical feeling. My stomach is in knots. This sounds pretty easy, but you'd be surprised how many of us never recognize our emotions or feelings. We offload instead. Rather than saying, "I failed and it feels so crappy," we move to, "I am a failure." We act out and shut down rather than reaching out. The goal here is simply to recognize that emotions and feelings are in play. Some of us might be alerted to emotion by our body's responses. Others know that something emotional is happening because our thoughts start racing or we have the event on slow motion replay. And others may recognize emotion is at hand only once their behavior sends up a flare, like yelling at their kids or firing off a shitty email to a colleague. For me, it all depends on the emotion. When I feel shame, sometimes my body's response is the first clue that I'm being hijacked by emotion. I can get tunnel vision and my heart races. My less than awesome blaming behavior is normally a sign that I'm resentful. And when I start rehearsing mean-spirited, gotcha conversations, I'm normally feeling vulnerable or afraid. Recognizing emotion means developing awareness about how our thinking, feeling, including our physiology, and behavior are connected. While some researchers and clinicians argue that you can change your life by just changing your thoughts, actions, or feelings, I've seen no evidence in my research that real transformation happens until we address all three as equally important parts of a whole, parts that are inextricably connected to one another, like a three-legged stool. Second, rising strong requires getting curious about our experience. This means having the willingness to open a line of inquiry into what's going on and why. Again, the good news is that you don't need to answer those questions right off the bat. You just need to want to learn more. For example, why am I being so hard on everyone around me today? Or what's setting me off? Or how did I get to the point where I want to punch a wall? Or I want to dig into why I'm so overwhelmed. Why can't I stop thinking about this conversation at work? Getting curious might even mean thinking, "Hey, I'm having such a strong emotional reaction. What's going on?" Or, "I know the Oreos are not going to work. What's really happening?" For example, your face turns red and heat radiates across your chest when you learn that your boss gave the lead for a new project to your colleague. Rising strong requires you to recognize that you're experiencing emotion and to get curious about why. "I'm so pissed off about her giving the lead to Todd. I need to figure this out before I lose it with everyone on our team." Or maybe your father is once again critical of your parenting during a holiday get-together. You basically check out. You're quiet and almost hiding the rest of the night. When you get home, you realize that you're full of emotion. You turn to your partner and say, "I'm so tired of feeling like crap around my father. I expect it to get better, but he never lets up. Why do I keep walking into this?" The reckoning sounds pretty straightforward, but like I said earlier, that's deceptive. And frankly, it's not the default for most of us. Don't forget that our bodies respond to emotion first, and they often direct us to shut down or disengage. In that first scenario, it's so much easier to steamroll right over emotion. "My boss is an asshole. Todd's such a brown noser. Who cares? This job sucks, and this company is a joke." There's been no recognition of emotion, no curiosity. In the second scenario, there are a number of options that are easier than engaging. We could buy into our father's criticism and stay completely withdrawn. We might start planning how we're going to impress him the next time. We could discharge our emotion by yelling at our partner for no reason. We could drink another beer or three, whatever it takes to drown the criticism. We could easily rage and blame the kids for making us look bad. We could spend the entire ride home vowing to never see our dad again. The list goes on. The opposite of recognizing that we're feeling something is denying our emotions. The opposite of being curious is disengaging. When we deny our stories and disengage from tough emotions, they don't go away. Instead, they own us. They define us. Our job is not to deny the story, but to defy the ending. To rise strong, recognize our story, and rumble with the truth until we get to a place where we think, yes, this is what happened. This is my truth, and I will choose how the story ends. In the following sections, I want to explore the two parts of the reckoning, recognizing emotion and getting curious. Specifically, I want to look at what gets in the way of both of these efforts and how we can develop new practices that give us both the tools and the courage to engage. Reckoning with emotion. What gets in the way of reckoning with emotion is exactly what gets in the way of engaging in other courageous behaviors. Fear. We don't like how difficult emotions feel, and we're worried about what people might think. We don't know what to do with the discomfort and vulnerability. Emotion can feel terrible, even physically overwhelming. We can feel exposed, at risk, and uncertain in the midst of emotion. Our instinct is to run from pain. In fact, most of us were never taught how to hold discomfort, sit with it, or communicate it, only how to discharge or dump it, or to pretend that it's not happening. If you combine that with the instinctual avoidance of pain, it's easy to understand why offloading becomes a habit. Both nature and nurture lead us to offload emotion and discomfort, often onto other people. The irony is that at the exact same time that we are creating distance between ourselves and the people around us by offloading onto others, we are craving deeper emotional connection and richer emotional lives. Miriam Greenspan, a psychotherapist and the author of Healing Through the Dark Emotions, was interviewed by Jungian therapist Barbara Plattick in The Sun magazine. The article has been required reading in my classes since it first appeared in 2008. Greenspan explains why she believes our culture is emotion phobic and that we fear and devalue emotion. She cautions, "But despite our fear, there is something in us that wants to feel all these emotional energies because they are the juice of life. When we suppress and diminish our emotions, we feel deprived. So we watch horror movies or so-called reality shows like Fear Factor. We seek out emotional intensity vicariously because when we are emotionally numb, we need a great deal of stimulation to feel something, anything. So emotional pornography provides the stimulation, but it's only ersatz emotion. It doesn't teach us anything about ourselves or the world. I don't think we can learn much about ourselves, our relationships, or the world without recognizing and getting curious about emotion. Fortunately, unlike navigating using dead reckoning, we don't need to immediately be precise in order to find our way. We just need to bring our feelings to light. We just need to be honest and curious. Even saying to ourselves, "Hey, I'm having an emotional reaction.